Yeah, this is a rather incestuous business because I'm talking about Jeff Harcourt, who's an economist. I'm introduced by a colleague of about 39 years, and so it's all rather incestuous, very much about the economics department. But I promise those people who are not economists, I'm not going to talk very much about economics. I wouldn't dare, actually, because I've already spotted in the audience three or four people who know a lot more economics than I do, and one or two people, in fact, who know more about Jeff Harcourt than I do. So it's a little bit stressful for me, in a sense. One of the things I did notice when I picked up the flyer for this, which I probably saw last of anybody, not through any fault of the organisers, but just because, you know, you get a flyer and you sort of know what you're doing anyway, I discovered what I was supposed to be talking about, and I also noticed that it was publicised as a free public talk. Well, I've never been paid to talk in my life, so I've talked a lot. So I thought this was a bit gratuitous in a sense, because I'm not used to anything but free talks in a sense. But there we are. Tom and I are old men of the tribe, and we go back, as he said. We came out from England within a year of each other, and we've been in the same department until he retired about a year ago, 2 years ago, and we've been in the same department. So we've been together for a long time in a sense, and we're probably I'm the oldest serving member of the economics department now, and there's quite a gap to the next one because there have been quite a few retirements. And so I suppose I do remember more about Jeff than most people who were in economics, because Jeff left us finally in 1982. When I was first asked to talk about Jeff, I thought, this is impossible. I mean, you know, this man has so many facets. Tom was saying I'm eclectic, but Jeff Harcourt is the ultimate eclectic, and so I hope I will sort of be able to show you in a few minutes. And I thought also, I just can't do justice to this man. And then I thought to myself, look, I'm retiring at the end of the year. This man has been so important to me in my life. I owe him at least one public talk about him, when I can really say what I think about him to other people, and give some other people something of a flavour of this man, who I think is quite a remarkable man in many ways. So then I said, yes, I'll do it for sure. And what I've got to be careful about in this is that because Jeff's been so important to me in my life, and I think he's been important to a lot of other people, but I've got to be very careful not to fall into gross hagiography. I mean, the man has been so important to me. As Tom said, I was in Cambridge in the early 1960s doing a PhD, and some people here will realise how stuffy, in a sense, Cambridge and Oxford were in many ways. I was English, but I'd come from Exeter, and Exeter had never been heard of in Cambridge. And Jeff was the only academic or Don who actually spoke civilly more or less to the PhD students, even, let alone the undergraduates. And this man, I rapidly realised, was a friendly man. He was a very intelligent, interesting man. And he even did things like, as Tom alluded to, he played sport with the postgrads, and I found myself playing squash against him regularly. And just to be absolutely personal, just for a couple of minutes, and then I'll get on to Jeff, I think I almost remember the moment. He turned to me at one stage, and towards the end of my PhD present sort of a preparation, I've been struggling with this wretched thing for about 3 years, and he said, do you want a job in Australia? And I'd never thought of such a thing. But I didn't have any real sort of things to prevent me going, and I thought, well, I ticked off. They speak English, because I'm no linguist. It's got a lot of sunshine. I've virtually never seen the sun, because that was before global warming, so Britain was freezing cold, horrible climate. I knew that they played cricket and were fairly mad on sport, and I knew there was lots of room there. And on that rather simple-minded basis, I said, so yeah, I'll think about it. And of course, in those days, and I hope I'm not saying anything that I shouldn't, because there might be some university administrators here, a professor like Jeff, and he'd just been made, given a personal chair in 1966, he could virtually say, well, we'll give you a job in Adelaide. And, of course, couldn't happen now. You've got to be transparent and equal opportunity and all these things. And I'm not saying anything about whether they're good or bad, but the fact is I wouldn't have had an earthly. But he said, do you want a job in Adelaide? And I thought about it for a few days, and my young wife agreed, and we were on the boat a few months later. And I came out on the assumption I'd be out here for 3 years, and I've never been back permanently. It's far too good out here. So I owe all that to Jeff. And at the micro level, being an economist, I talk like this. At the micro level, when I arrived here on a boat, because you came out in boats then, wonderful holiday on the boat, first class, you know, sitting on the table with the chief engineer. We'd had a big boozy session the night before we reached Adelaide, and I was hungover, and I thought you had to dress up. And I got off the boat in the only suit I've ever owned, and it was about it was January 1967, and it was 96 Fahrenheit, I think. And I was met by two professors. One was Jeff Harcourt, and the other one was Eric Russell, who was Jeff Harcourt's great mentor and lifelong friend. And they were in shorts, open-neck shirts. And then I drove out after a couple of hours mucking about, we drove out of the port and up Port Road, and the galvanised iron was sort of, you know, the sun was beating off this galvanised iron. And I thought, what the devil have I come to? I couldn't recognise it, and I was hungover as well, and stifled by my English suit and all that sort of thing. Anyway, I rapidly realised that these were wonderful people, and it was a great sort of introduction to Australia. Those are the personal comments, and I don't want to... I'll make one other personal comment, because Tom made something about it, and I'm not going to talk about economics a huge amount. I will get to it in a minute. Tom alluded to my being an ornithologist. I call myself a bird watcher more because I'm not a professional. But in any relationship with another human being, in this case with Jeff, I think you like to feel that it's a bit reciprocal. And Jeff's had a profound impact on my life, in not only in the way I've just said, but in all sorts of other ways. And I maybe have had very small effect on him. And the one thing I have always hoped that I did do, when I first met Jeff, I found he did one of the most unspeakable things I think a human being can do. He kept caged birds. And I apologise to those people here who still keep them. And I spent several early years hacking away at this caged bird business. He had all sorts of poor little wretched things in cages in his garden on Cross Road. And eventually he gave up caged birds, and I felt that I'd been partly responsible for at least just marginally responsible for turning him against this particular obscenity, which I hope one day all human beings will stop. I think caged birds are an obscenity. Okay, I'm going to now... I said when I was first responded to this, I said I wasn't going to use any sort of electronic aids or anything like that, or even electricity aids, in the spirit of Jeff himself, who has the greatest difficulty sending an email. Indeed, I don't think I've ever had an email from him. You tend to get them from Joan, his wife, or from the secretary at the college or something like that, because I believe that he's not really into email, doesn't know how to do it. But what I'm going to do is to use a few overheads, just to give you some idea of some of the more simple factual things, but I'm not going to give you a lot of it. What I want to do first is to put up a little quote from someone which was, which came to me unsolicited about 2 days ago, from someone who shall be nameless. You shall be. Maybe not going to use this. Take a little time to warm up. Yes, well, okay, well, that's nice because it'll emerge slowly. I thought it was a nice little quote that encapsulated a lot of the things I think a lot of us feel about Jeff. And I've edited it a bit, and it's by somebody who's a professor of economics, and he just asked me about. It will in a second. You will in a second. And I think it captures a lot of what's true about Jeff. He's had this sort of impact on a lot of people. You meet him, he's unforgettable. He'll say something or do something which you cannot forget for the rest of your life, I think, if you meet him for very long. And I think this gentleman captured it very well in this little statement. He posed some sort of view of economics that Jeff was in. Jeff immediately jumped in and talked about it, and they had a brief conversation, 30 minutes, and as this gentleman said, changed his little mind. Jeff had a big one. Jeff has a wonderful, expansive mind, and will take on almost any interesting issue or idea. I should say there, by the way, I just said had, and twice today I've had the bizarre problem of people coming up and saying something, thinking Jeff was passed on. Indeed, I was in the Adelaide Arcade today, and an old student of Jeff's and mine, who was quite a senior public servant at one stage some years ago, walked up to me and said, "Oh, he's speaking about Jeff Harcourt tonight." And I said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "Oh, very sad about him." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, is he dead?" And I said, "Not to my knowledge." Very much not so. But I thought, well, maybe he knows something I don't know, and that Jeff passed away last night. But I'm very happy to say that a very close friend of Jeff's, Bob Wallace, is in the audience and assures me that he spoke to Jeff's daughter last night and he was still alive in England a few hours ago. Anyway, I think that really encapsulates what a lot of us remember about Jeff, and I know there's some students of his here tonight and some old colleagues. And he was just an unforgettable person, or he is an unforgettable person. I'm lapsing into this. Let me now put up very quickly, and I'm not going to bore you with this sort of thing for very long, just a chronology of Jeff's career. So we know where we are. I've got some things here on the table which I know people are looking at. I'm going to talk about those briefly when it's appropriate. Born in Melbourne, twin brother John, who was an academic dentist until very recently when he retired, I think. Jeff was the elder of the twins. And in Jeff's own words, an assimilationist Jewish household he grew up in. Indeed, I heard the other day from a good source that Jeff claims he didn't know he was Jewish until he was 10. And he went to school and somebody said something to him, which I won't repeat. But and then he thought, well, what does that mean? And he went home and asked. So obviously his household was not one in which they were very conscious of being Jewish, and Jeff himself was not brought up, I don't think, as Jewish in any sense at all. I don't think Jeff really loved his schooling in Melbourne. He went to a fairly nice private school. But what is interesting is, and I don't like reading overheads, it's awfully boring, but when he started at Melbourne University in 1950, in several of his autobiographical writings, of which there are quite a lot, he uses this phrase, heaven on earth. He really, when he went to Melbourne University, he really suddenly felt that life was wonderful because his intellectual curiosity was aroused, and he uses this phrase, heaven on earth, as he started his BCom, and he stayed there and did a master's. So that was a great turning point in his life, I think. And another thing that's been very, very important, I'll come back to this in a minute when I get more general about him, he was never raised as a Jew, and it wasn't, as he says, a sort of consciously Jewish household. But Jeff converted to Christianity. He did it formally. And as far as I know, he converted to what was then Methodism, which is now Uniting Church. And this has been a very, very important part of his life ever since. And very, very important of his part of his economics as well. And then he began his love affair with Cambridge in England. And I suppose initially it was not entirely chance. He went to Keynes College. Keynes is old college, King's College, Cambridge, which if anybody who's been to Cambridge knows is an extraordinarily beautiful college. But there are many beautiful colleges there. And I suppose it's then that he started this lifelong love of Cambridge and, of course, of Cambridge-style economics, etc. Thank you, Tom. That's a good chairman's role. And then he came back to... There's only two pages of this, and then I'll get on to much more discursive things. He he came to Adelaide University in 1958 as a lecturer, and he went off for three years actually, to another college at Cambridge, Trinity Hall. So you can sense here that he was very, very much in love with Cambridge at this stage and really wanted to get back there. He went back there in 1963 to Trinity Hall, and then a very important part of his life, he returned to Adelaide in 1966, incidentally bringing me with him, not quite bringing me with him, but having sort of organised for me to come. And then I think another very important thing in Jeff's life, and there's a copy of the book there, was his first serious sort of book that he wrote or was involved in, which was one with Bob Wallace is sitting here in the audience, and Peter Carmel, who some people here will know very much of. He published a little book called Economic Activity, which he was always very, very proud, and I think rightly so. It was used for many, many years in first year macroeconomics courses, as we call them in Australia. And he got involved very heavily, as a lot of people also know, in the late 1960s and early 70s in the Peace in Vietnam movement. And in fact, he was the chairman of that and the president and had several roles in that. He'd already been given a personal chair in 1967. In 1967 to 82, he had a very, very long period in Adelaide, which is the period that Tom and I would have known him most, in a sense, because he was here most of the time, although he used to make little trips off to Canada and Japan to do various things in economics. And then in 1982, he was appointed to this curiously titled ad hominem, I'm sorry about the spelling error there, ad hominem, readership in the history of economic theory at Cambridge, and as a fellow at his third Cambridge College, Jesus College. These are all very, very prestigious colleges, very ancient ones. And I suppose this is technically the end of Jeff's employment in Adelaide, but he was made an emeritus professor here in 1988, and I think we can say that even though he hasn't been here in the last 19 years, he's still been very, very interested, and he comes back to Australia and to Adelaide. He was here about 2 or 3 months ago, and he's bought a flat in Sydney, in Randwick, and I think we'll see more of him actually now than we have done even in the last few years, because he has a son who's in Melbourne and various other, and has other connections here. Anyway, I don't want to dwell too much on these sorts of details. I want to talk more about his general personality, character, etc. As I say, most of you are not economists, don't want to be probably. So I want to talk about four themes in Jeff's life which he's picked up himself. He's picked them up in his autobiographical writing, and they're fairly consistent. One is an interest in politics in the broad. And when I say politics, I mean, obviously his main enthusiasm, main skills are in economics. But he believes that politics and economics are closely intertwined. He doesn't believe that you can do economics without thinking about politics and thinking about values and things like that. A second one, and these in no particular order, is sport, which I'll say a little bit about at some stage. A third one is his religion, which he takes very seriously and which I believe informs his political and economic thinking. And it's a very, very important part of his life, and to some people it's an anomaly, in a sense, because one thinks of economists as being the servants of mammon. But Jeff doesn't. And I suppose, obviously, the fourth one is his children and his family. And he would identify those as all extraordinarily important. Let me start by just saying a little bit about his economics and how he has pursued it and what sort of role he feels it plays in his life. First of all, Jeff is not a person who does his economics when he's, say, at a university or something like that, and then forgets about it, goes home, forgets about it. He's not somebody who goes home or comes to work and thinks, I've got to publish a paper. For Jeff, economics and politics intertwined and his value system are all a very fundamental part of his life. Now, that's, I'm not saying it's unique, but it's unusual increasingly when academics feel that it's a career and you basically do it in order to, have a job and make money and to basically get promoted, etc. I mean, Jeff cannot not be an economist. Once he'd seen the light, in a sense, and been trained and been exposed to Keynes and Keynesian economics and other people and some of his great mentors, I can say, and I think other people who knew him well will agree, he's always an economist. He's an economist at weekends. He's an economist on public holidays. He's an economist all the time. Now, you may think that's a rather sad thing, but he's also a lot of other things, and he doesn't let it always get in the way of other things. But, I mean, he's famed for being someone who is always an economist in a sense, and it's intertwined with other things, his religion, his political views, his compassion in general. And so in that sense, he's always an economist. And I think it's fair to say, and here I will put up a few more little things, that when he was in, when he came back to Adelaide in 1966, 67, he very quickly became one of the, and this is something I wrote about him with Ray Petrides as a West Australian economist. I wrote about this in 1996, wrote this about Jeff. He became a very one of the best-known economists in Australia, both as a theorist in his own right, but also as somebody who was involved in policy, etc., etc. And more than that, more importantly than that, Jeff has always been a wonderful sort of mentor for young economists. And there are an enormous number of people in the system who, in our political system, our economic system, working in Canberra and Sydney still, who were either taught by Jeff or were affected by things he wrote, because he is an enormous output. I was surprised myself, even though I know him very well, but I was surprised at the enormous numbers of papers that he'd written on an enormous range of topics. And so I think it's fair to say that his role has been as a mentor, very widespread role as a mentor, very important role as a mentor for an enormous number of young economists over several decades. And that's a very, very important role indeed. Anybody who's met Jeff, and I'll put up a couple of pictures of him here so people remember what he looks like, because he has been around quite a long time, will recall how he was such an important person on campus. I mean, when he was involved in the campaign for peace in Vietnam, became quite a public figure in another dimension. I mean, the dimension of leading marches down North Terrace and things like that. But he still maintained his role as an economist. He still was involved in policy issues, and he was still involved quite often in the media, etc., in times when the media were often more interested in academics than they are possibly now. I should say a little bit about his other passions in life. I've already mentioned, I think, that his religious beliefs meant that he took economics as a sort of very much a human science, in a sense. And he always said, because he knew it about himself, he always says that before you do any economics, you should make quite clear what your own value system is. He's one of those sorts of economists that says you've got to basically put your own value system up front so that people can judge what you're saying in the context of your value system. In other words, economics is not value-free. He's never believed that. And that's a very, very important way in which he's differentiated possibly from some other economists who feel that economics is just another version of physics or maths, and you can, disassociate it from a person's values or beliefs. And so that's been a very, very important part of his approach to economics. I suppose it's sort of a bit of a sadness for Jeff in his economics has been, I think, captured a little bit by this, a couple of quotations again, but he never really built a school or a dynasty in Adelaide. Now, he might, if he were here, thank God he's not, I wish he were, but he might be annoyed with me for saying this, but I think it's true, and you could ask why. It was a bit of a sadness to him. He never really built up a school of people around him, and I think the only way I can explain this was that he's too complex a human being to be followed by a lot of people. He's not a stereotype ideologue in any sense at all. He constantly surprises you with the diversity of his thinking, etc. He's an eclectic. And so it's very, very hard to pin him down to a position. And for that reason, I think I can't think of a better one, he's not inconsistent exactly. As I say there, he's tolerant, flexible, and this is something I wrote about him at one stage. He's always can see the other side of the argument. And, you know, I can remember some examples. Tom probably remembers him. He'd come in, say, he'd been on an interstate, and he'd been, you know, he's involved in the campaign for peace in Vietnam. And there was a man locally, and I hope he's not here, John McClay, who was a right-wing sort of politician who firmly believed in the Vietnam War. And Jeff gets on the aeroplane, and he finds himself sitting next to John McClay. And the irony of it probably hit him, and then he'd start talking to John McClay. And, you know, they find they both love cricket, and talk about the footy, and, you know, he finds it. And he'd come into the tea room, he'd get off the plane, he'd come into the tea room, I think I can remember this happening, he'd walk into the tea room and he'd say, "Oh, it's funny, I was just on the aeroplane, I met that bastard McClay. He's not a bad guy." You know, this was Jeff. He'd say, "He's actually quite a nice guy." And I'd say, "Jeff, how can you say that? You know, he tried to, he's been denigrating you in the press and all this sort of thing." And this was Jeff. I mean, he will always see the other side of, he always see the other man's point of view or woman's point of view. And this is a very lovable feature of him, but of course it doesn't always make for good ideologue. He's not been a good ideologue. And I think it's fair to sum it up by saying it's been Jeff's fate to be admired by many, indeed almost everybody, but not joined by a lot of people, because he's far too difficult to pin down, in a sense. You can't join him easily. Very, very difficult. And something else I should say about Jim, which is very important, is a ridiculously long paragraph for something that's on an overhead. And this is almost the last one, by the way, and I'll just talk about it. If I've got another 10 minutes, have I?
I think so, yes.
Right. There was an almost unique and extraordinary tea room culture which built up largely around Jeff Harcourt's personality. It wasn't solely Jeff. There were other people. I have to mention Fred Block, who was an extraordinary personality in the Commerce Department, who's still around. But it was... And there were all sorts of curious incidents, and Tom will know what this one was about. It's not so funny when you read it now, but I can remember it with great humour. We had, for instance, I remember a very not brash exactly, a very refined, actually, and confident young man came from Britain, public school system, you know, was doing a PhD, walked into the tea room, sat down, and the incredible democracy of this tea room was that he walks in, he's just got there, and there's this personal chair, Jeff Harcourt there, and they immediately got into a vigorous debate about something. And they disagreed violently. I mean, this was a fairly right-wing sort of at the time and new chum from England. And he got into this debate. Didn't even know Jeff was, I don't think, at the time, and insulted him intellectually sort of thing. And but the tea room was such that at this stage that Jeff and this man became very, very good friends. I mean, they never agreed particularly. And the tea room culture was one of... It was a clearinghouse for scandal and for gossip and a safety valve for the whole of the department. And when we had visitors from places like America, they often would say, "I wish we had a tea room like this." They had some sort of sterile situation where you went to a machine or something or got a coffee and went back to your room. We had a thing where basically you went somewhere at 11:15 or 3:45 and you stayed there for as long as you could, because if you left... You got talked about. It was dangerous. It was positively dangerous. And I do remember some very tough, seasoned people from other parts of the humanities and social sciences who would come into our tea room with great temerity, because they really thought that this was quite a dangerous place to come. And basically, as I say there, not to be there at 11 or 4 was to be probably ashamed, despised, and in considerable danger. I mean, you had to be there. It's not like that now. This is the old sort of collegial world that probably died out in most universities, or has died out in most universities in the last 10 or 20 years. And it didn't just wasn't confined to the economics department, because I can remember Jeff going into the staff club, the old staff club and the newer one, and... In those days, people from economics, physics, law, history would all sit together and have lunch, and there was a real collegiality. I don't want to be too old-fashioned about this, but Jeff was very much at the heart of this. He loved it. He loved mixing with other people in the university and testing his ideas on them and things like that. I think that's a
very, very important feature of the man. And in a wider sphere,
it led us to have a wonderful flow of visitors. And one or two people here who are economists will remember that Jeff was a networker. He wouldn't have ever used a modish word like that. He probably only just about heard of it now. But we had a flow of very famous economists. And I think it's fair to say that most of them came to Adelaide because Jeff was here. They'd come into, say, Sydney or Melbourne sometimes anyway, but they'd then come to Adelaide. And some of them just came straight to Adelaide, didn't even go to Sydney or Melbourne. They included, and these names will only mean something probably in the main to economists, but I can remember sitting in our tea room, which still exists, Harry Johnson, Joan Robinson, Sir John, Lady Hicks, Colin Clark, Kenneth Boulding twice, and these include Nobel Prize winners. Those of you who are economists will recognise two or three Nobel Prize winners. And Jeff was a magnet for these people. I'm not saying he was in the same league himself, and he wouldn't either, but he was a magnet for them because he was truly international. And also we attracted politicians because Jeff has always had, and I haven't really mentioned this sufficiently, he's always had a deep-seated affinity with the Labor Party in Australia, and indeed much of his best policy work was done behind the scenes mainly, he was never up front, behind the scenes work on economics for... That's all right, Tom. For the Labor Party. And Bill Hayden was in our tea room a couple of times, I remember. And Jeff was, you know, had a close relationship with the Labor Party for several years, particularly, obviously, when they came into office. It's interesting to talk, say, a little bit about his public role in economics. He wanted to be involved in the real world, in policy and things like that, and indeed he flirted with it. And he was, I think, once or twice invited to ask whether he was interested in major policy roles and even jobs. And I think he took the advice of some of his better friends and said, "Look, Jeff, you know what should happen. You could give very good policy advice, but you're not wicked enough. You're not strategic enough. You're not. You couldn't play these games that these people play." And I think Jeff quite rightly backed off once or twice when he was offered major sort of policy roles. But nevertheless, he was very, very important behind the scenes, because I think he had a couple of formal policy advice positions for the Labor Party just before they came into power for that long period. And I think if people who were here at the time will remember the so-called Adelaide Plan, possibly, which was very much the child of Harcourt and a couple of his colleagues, and which was based upon, I think, three very important things. And one was that Jeff was a good economist with a good economic theory background, albeit not technical. I mean, Jeff's always been a non-technical economist. He's not a mathematician. But he does understand, I think, the basic theory. And, well, I know he does. It's a terrible thing to say, I think he does, I know he does. But what's more important in a way is, I think Jeff has an incredibly good understanding of Australian institutions and values. He's a great sort of Australian patriot. And, of course, most importantly of all, Jeff is a great lover of humanity. So he really wants to do good, and that's a very Keynesian sort of view of the world. I mean, it's very like his great mentor Keynes, who, I suppose some people would say Keynes was operating on a sort of noblesse oblige basis, but Jeff certainly had that view that economist's role was to try and improve the world and to look after people, make people's lives better. And he's pursued that all his career. And I think it is based on those very, very solid foundations. I mean, I suppose he's been a bit disappointed in a way because not all of his ideas have always, that's true for most of us, all of his ideas have come to fruition. But there's no doubt that the Adelaide Plan sowed the seeds for the Accord, which the Labor government cemented with Labor, with the Labor movement, I mean, and which was a very successful policy tool for quite a long time and seems to have been, very... It's always counterfactual, but I mean, seems to have been a very successful part of Australian policy for some years. So I think Jeff
wasn't entirely unsuccessful as a policy advisor.
Probably the most important work that he ever did in economics was his remarkable assessment, and I call it, of what became known as the Cambridge Controversies. Now, this is amazingly arcane and technical. It's not mathematical, really, but it's arcane and technical. And I think Jeff really loved the contest because it was a sort of mock contest between Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Cambridge in England. And people largely lined up on those two, not completely, but largely on those two alignments. And Jeff, of course, saw it as the good old-fashioned, well-meaning sort of Cambridge, England sort of views against the slick and clever New World views. And to some extent, he enjoyed it as a contest. And he wrote a book on this subject, which became basically the main text on it. And it's still probably the best and most readable account of what is indeed very, very arcane economics, and so I won't talk a lot about it. But it did give him an international reputation, a really international reputation. And I think, it was a very great achievement for an Australian economist, and I say that without any rank or anything, but I mean for somebody in Australia to become internationally well known in an area of middle theory was a great achievement. Not many Australian economists have managed that.
Said a lot really about him as a man, but I suppose this
summarises what I think about him in many ways. That I said earlier, he's always seen life, politics, which he thinks is life a lot, intertwined with economics, and you shouldn't try to do one without the other. And it's very Keynesian, this. It's in the tradition of Keynes. And I've said something about the Adelaide Plan and about, I think, what is a very sensible and patriotic view of Australia. He recognised early on that Australia had some characteristics which, in economics terms, I've got to turn to economics a little bit, in economics terms, it's a relatively small economy, pretty open economy in many ways, has certain institutions which Jeff, I think, understood quite well, and value systems which he also understood well, and I think he analysed these and put them together and came up with some policy packages which were, as I say, it's very hard to test these policy packages, but I think that they were sensible often, and they certainly were extremely important in framing the way in which the Labor government operated for some years. As I say, he never really came up front as a policy person. Let me say now something which I was almost loath to go into, and that is I was worried that I would be a bit hagiographical, if that is the word, about Jeff. So I'm going to say a couple of things which I think I might say as almost as weaknesses, and I hope nobody will report these to him. First of all, as an administrator in the university, he was head of the school for about a year, and he always talked about it. I don't think he really liked doing it. It was sort of almost forced on him. And I was going to say that he was not really extraordinarily comfortable with it. He didn't really like it. And I think in many ways that's, to parody a cliche, he's praising with faint damning. He didn't want to be an administrator, and I think that's a good thing in a real academic. I think another problem with him is, and here I am stepping onto difficult ground, but I think I ought to say what I think, Jeff is a man with so many friends and so many acquaintances that it's very, very difficult at times to know whether you're really talking to him or whether he's because he really is overloaded with networks. And at times you wonder sometimes, or I wondered sometimes, I'd be talking to him and I'd think, well, really, Jeff, I think you want to be somewhere else or you're doing something else, or you're not sure whether he's really engaging with him. And I don't think that's unfair. I think it's it's inevitable. I mean, an economist would understand it. He has enormous numbers of networks and he knows an enormous number of people. Another thing about him is that he himself said this. He's very, very into I won't call it hero worship, but he does like to have heroes. And some of them, I think, are perfectly valid, etc., but it's a tendency on his part to want to look for heroes. And indeed, much of his later writings in the last 10 or 15 years have been biographical sort of things about some of his heroes, many of whom are economists. And of course, they start with Keynes and then with some people locally. Eric Russell, I've mentioned before, and I don't want to cause blushes, but Bob Wallace, who he's been a friend of for a very, very long time, and I believe taught him in Melbourne very early on, and a couple of other people who he sees as being fundamental to his own life in economics. Now, there's nothing wrong with heroes, but Jeff does at times, you know, like to sort of identify heroes and talk about them. I, of course, wasn't connecting that in any way with the people I mentioned. One curious weakness, and it relates in a way to what Tom said when he introduced me, was that Jeff has always had a great interest in Australian art, Australian literature, but I've never heard Jeff express an opinion of any sort on music. He claims to be tone deaf, but I think that's just a cop-out in a way. I don't believe in tone deafness quite. But I don't know whether I'm wrong there, and Bob, I'm not sure whether Bob will agree, but it's almost there's a black hole in Jeff. I've never heard him, I've never known him turn around and say, oh, that's a beautiful piece of music, or did you hear that? He doesn't seem to have any interest in music. That's a very possible gap in his sort of character, in a sense, for me at least. But there we are. But apart from that, I mean, a quite remarkable man, as I hope I indicated or tried to indicate. And my last little overhead. He's continued to make contributions to economic policy, particularly in Australia still. It's amazing. He still writes about enormous output. He still writes about Australia. And I think he's, in a sense, a patriot in the very, very best sense of that word, which is often used derogatively now. He's a very optimistic and generous man. And I think, as I've said once, and I wrote something about him, that he beguiles both his opponents, his intellectual opponents, and his supporters. He's very hard to dislike, the man. I mean, I don't virtually know no one who does. He's a memorable man and a very nice man. And, of course, what I haven't done, really, is to say much about some of his more... he wouldn't think of them as unimportant, but things that he does at play. I perhaps should just mention very, very briefly, because there's some little pieces there. He has a lifelong interest in sport, and he somehow manages to draw sport into economics and politics and everything else, and all these other things he does. In particular, he played Australian rules football until he was about 47 or something like that, and he was a small man, relatively small man, and of course, you know, other people would say to him, look, Jeff, you know, there's some 18-year-old, about 16 stone, who you failed in the last Echo 1 exam. There you are, exposing yourself to the possibility of being shirt-fronted by this person who's, you know, quarter your age or something, or third your age or something like that. And he's managed to survive that. Joan often was terrified of this happening to him. He's still, well, he's just about given up cricket, I think. He still talks about it. And he was absolutely fanatical about cricket. And then he was involved, I know, in a curious phenomenon in the 1950s, late 50s, 1960s, called Battington, which was a curious game, one of those games that was invented by a small group of people, basically in a local area. I think there was a small part of the university here on campus, only a few metres from here probably, where there was a curious configuration of walls and some people with some sort of imagination managed to invent a game which suited this configuration. And the Battington Bats, those two of the... there must have been at least four because they played doubles. It was a sort of cross between squash and rackets and badminton and probably several other things. Those are two of the original Battington bats used in the 1950s and 60s by some very eminent economists and one or two other people as well. There's at least one person sitting in this audience here who used those bats. Their DNA will be on the handles. I haven't checked it yet, but I'm thinking about it. I inherited those some years ago, and I found them the other day and thought I ought to attend to them here. And so sport has been, for Jeff, an extraordinarily important part of his life. And it's one of the more sort of nicer sort of features of him, I think, that he can turn from very deep thought about arcane things like capital theory and then talk with great enthusiasm about some trivial sporting event or something. He doesn't see it as trivial. Some sporting event. So that's I think, one of the lovely features of the man. And I could talk also about many of his other interests. He was, I should perhaps remind people that he was deeply involved with the Howard League for a long time, which was the sort of association looked after people when they came out of prison and things like that. He's just a man of immense capacity and interest in life. And as I said when I started this talk, I've had a couple of people ask me if he's dead. He's definitely not dead. When I last saw him a couple of months ago and we had dinner with him, a couple of us in the audience here, he was still very much alive. He's well over 70 now. He's in his mid-70s. But he has undiminished enthusiasm and passion for the things he does. And it's hard to know what will stop him. And I hope nothing does for a very long time. He likes to call himself, and I'll finish on this note, he likes to call himself a Cambridge economist, but an Australian patriot. And I think that identifies, in a way, the sort of tension in his life. He was seduced by Cambridge and Keynes and the intellectual firmament there, and he's gone back there finally now for a long time, and he may come back to Australia eventually, but he spent a lot of time in Cambridge, England. But he still loves Australia, and he has enormous affection for it. So a Cambridge economist, but an Australian patriot. And I think that's a very nice way to think of a man who is certainly, to me, has been a very, very important part of my life. And as I say, I think a few of you here, from comments were made to me before I started speaking, remember him with the same sort of affection. And he still comes back here. He was here a few months ago, and there's a picture of him there, so when you next meet him around campus, you'll know who he is. And you can stop and talk to him. He's an inveterate talker. As people know, I think I remember him saying once that any time spent not talking was time wasted. And that's a bit unfair to himself, because he was a man of considerable concentration and was capable of turning to matters and concentrating on them massively, as he did in his Capital Theory book. When I used to cycle in from, because we lived fairly near each other, I lived at Hawthorne, he lived at, I've forgotten what the suburb was called. Can't remember anyway. It was on the same direction. We used to cycle in together, and he'd talk about these incredibly difficult things, which I couldn't understand. And I don't think Jeff understood them for very long at times. He admitted that. He'd understand if it's like general relativity theory, you know, you'd think, oh, got it. And then 10 minutes later, he'd think, lost it. I mean, I'm sure there are a few people like Einstein who could hang on to these things, but Jeff would talk about, there's a horrible thing called double switching and another thing called capital reversing, and they're very, very technical. And you'd think, got it. And Jeff would say, oh, he'd explain it to you. And then 10 minutes later, you'd say, well, Jeff, what did you really mean by that? And he'd say, well, I'm not sure myself, but very honest. But anyway, he convinced the world that he knew all about it. So, and the last thing I want to say is, because there was a little commercial at the beginning, Ray did a little commercial about Tom's book, and I was going to do that, actually. I came in here and I was going to talk about our Australia's own Cold War. I was going to talk about that, but as Ray said something about that, I'll say something else commercial. There is a move by some old students of Jeff's, Melbourne-based mainly, to set up a foundation to have a chair, a visiting chair named after Jeff and for distinguished economists. And if anybody's interested in knowing about that, I've got one or two of the brochure things out here. If people want to pick them up for me, they can. So that's a small commercial. We're trying to set up a sort of chair which will be basically in honour of and perpetuate Jeff's sort of ideas and values and views of economics, which I think are extraordinarily valuable. Thank you very much.